The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Let's let our negotiators get on. I think where Leo Varadkar and I got to was a joint feeling that there is a way forward. We can see a pathway to a deal. That doesn't mean it's a done deal. So there's work to be done.
That was UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking yesterday. But this is House of Commons leader Jacob Rees-Mogg speaking to Sophie Ridge and Sky News yesterday. Clearly, he does not have an appetite for any proposed extensions.
The Prime Minister has been absolutely clear we are leaving on the 31st of October. This is of great importance. I mean, you've heard what the Prime Minister has said. He is not going to Europe to ask for an extension. He's going to say, shall we do this deal or shall we leave without a deal, and to see where that goes. That endless extensions are not doing us any good. They're not solving the problem.
Well, after talks between Leo Varadkar and Johnson prompted a new surge of optimism that a Brexit deal could be reached, intensive talks over the weekend were described by the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, as difficult, suggesting once again that hopes of an agreement were in the balance. Now, to get reaction and analysis as we face into a pivotal week, I'm joined on the line by Sean Defoe, Communicore Group political correspondent, by Jack Parrock, Brussels correspondent for Euronews, and by George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times, a Euro all very welcome. Now, we'll go to you, George Parker, first. All the key figures were out yesterday on the political programmes on television. Maybe you bring us up to speed on where they all stand. I mean, I played a little bit of Jacob Rees-Mogg there. He has got great faith in Boris Johnson to deliver a Brexit.
Yes, I mean, there are people on the Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party who are investing a great deal of faith in Boris Johnson to deliver Brexit. And frankly, I think Boris Johnson could bring back almost exactly the same deal as Theresa May, and they would vote for it because it's Boris Johnson rather than Theresa May. And you're starting to pick a bit of that up from the discourse of people like Jacob Rees-Mogg. Because frankly, the kind of deal that Boris Johnson's talking about in Brussels at the moment, in some respects, is probably worse for the DUP and by extension people like Jacob Rees-Mogg than Theresa May's original deal. But yes, they're investing faith in Boris Johnson to deliver on this. I think they're still sort of cautious optimism that something might be possible in Downing Street on that.
Now, if it's bad for the DUP, does it mean that the ERG and Jacob Rees-Mogg and his allies will ditch the DUP?
So far, that hasn't been the case. I mean, there are 28 hardline ERG, European Research Group Tories, who voted against the deal last time. They have indicated that they will back the deal if the DUP back it. And I think certainly the DUP is regarded as the canary in the mine on this, that it's okay with the DUP, then a lot of the ERG people will come on board. I think at the end of the day, I suspect that some Tories will abandon the DUP, which is what we saw back in last March, of course, when Jacob Rees-Mogg, amongst others, said they wouldn't back the deal unless the DUP did. Well, the DUP didn't, and then Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg did back Theresa May's deal. So I think their loyalty to the DUP is has its limits.
So even if the canary is gasping for breath, they may abandon that canary. Now, on the other parties, the Labour Party, I mean, it's very confusing. Shall we have an election first and a people's vote second, or a people's vote first and an election second? But I heard Jeremy Corbyn say that this deal is so bad that they won't back it one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is becoming increasingly isolated, I think, in his own party on this. Jeremy Corbyn, as we discussed many times before, in his heart is a Brexiteer. He's always opposed Britain's EU membership and probably continues to do so. And he's also alone on this in the sense that he thinks that he could fight a general election and do well in a general election. He still remembers doing well in 2017 and has invested in himself powers to win over the British public if only he can get on a soapbox and talk to them. That view isn't shared by a large number of his own senior colleagues, including notably people like John McDonnell, who's a key lieutenant of Jeremy Corbyn. They're worried that if there's an election with Brexit unresolved, in other words, a Brexit election, the Labour Party will be annihilated because its fence-sitting leaves them in such a precarious position. They'll be picked off by the Tories and the Brexit Party on one side and by the anti-Brexit Liberal Democrats on the other. So Mr. Corbyn is starting to look quite exposed, and there's a big moment of truth coming up next Saturday, so-called Super Saturday, when the House of Commons meets for the first time in 40 years on a Saturday, when the Labour Party will have to decide, is it a party which wants a referendum on whatever deal Boris Johnson gets, or are they going to go for an election? And I think the pressure is now mounting on Mr. Corbyn to try to attach a confirmatory referendum to any deal Boris Johnson brings back.
Now, he has ambitions to be a caretaker prime minister, but those ambitions, he dealt himself a self-inflicted blow when he was questioned about the SNP and whether or not he would grant Scotland another referendum on its own independence. And he said no, certainly not in the early years of my prime ministerial tenure. So therefore, goodbye SNP, voting Jeremy Corbyn in as caretaker. The SNP, they don't like the deal that's shaping up either.
No, they don't. I mean, the SNP opposes Brexit, obviously, and they don't like the deal. And as you mentioned there, the problem is getting all these opposition parties to agree on a course of action to enable a second referendum. And the idea of Mr. Corbyn being put into Downing Street is not only anathema to certainly to the 21 Conservative MPs who were boosted out of the Tory party a month or so ago, certainly don't want that to happen. And I think that is a potential problem. And that, as far as the SNP are concerned, the Labour Party again are speaking with two voices. So Jeremy Corbyn says, no, we can't grant an independence referendum. John McDonnell, waiting in the wings there, said exactly the opposite at the Edinburgh Festival back in August. So the Labour Party position on this, as with a load of other things at the moment, is all over the place.
And then the Liberal Democrats, who are a decidedly Remain party, and they believe that in an election they will pick up a lot of seats, probably nothing approaching what would be required to form a government, but they're not going to give Johnson any comfort at all by supporting his deal. So I'm just wondering, the way all the numbers look like adding up for Super Saturday, what chances does Boris Johnson have of getting whatever emerges from the tunnel through Parliament?
Well, let's say he gets the deal and he brings it back to Parliament. Getting the DUP on board, people often say the DUP don't matter so much anymore. Now that Boris Johnson's majority is so far into negative territory, what difference 10 MPs make? Well, they do still make quite a bit of difference. 10 MPs in this context is still important, particularly if they bring on board a lot of ERG people. So if somehow he can persuade the DUP to back it, then I think most of the ERG MPs will support it. Then he probably needs a handful of Labour MPs to back the deal as well. My guess is, if they're in the unlikely event that a deal emerges from Brussels on Friday evening sometime, that there'll be a number of Labour MPs who will just think that we're going to get, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to suffer very badly in the election if we have an election with Brexit unresolved, particularly in Leave seats, that now's the time to just get this over and done with. So I think Boris Johnson possibly could get it over the line, but the arithmetic is extremely tight.
The final question, George, is if there is an amendment added which insists on a people's vote after the Brexit deal is confirmed by the House of Commons, what then? I mean, could we find a situation where Boris Johnson and his mates would have to vote against the very deal that they've just negotiated with Michel Barnier?
Well, I mean, that is one potentially perverse outcome of all this. The referendum, the so-called people's vote, the last time it was put to a vote in the House of Commons, it lost by about 12 votes. It would be extremely tight. Now, the question I have in my mind is, if Boris Johnson comes back from Brussels with a deal and there's a huge sigh of relief around the country, and then Parliament says, well, hang on a sec, we want to have another public vote on this, have another 3 or 4 months of uncertainty, divisions and all the rest of it, I wonder whether in the end Parliament would vote for that if a deal had just been signed in Brussels. I'm not sure that they would. But if they did, you're right, it's quite possible that the Tories wouldn't be able to support their own deal because of the referendum being attached to it. So it's going to be interesting Saturday, to say the least.
Yeah. And finally, that whole business about the having to write to Brussels and ask for an extension if a deal is not delivered. Where do we stand on that? Still trickery afoot?
Well, the so-called Benn Act, as you say, requires Boris Johnson to write this letter if there's no deal agreed by Saturday. There have been all sorts of rumours about what Boris Johnson might do, whether he was going to challenge his thoughts. He might do that, first of all, because to make it look like he's exhausted all opportunities, I think he would lose in the courts. some speculation that he might squat in number 10 Downing Street and challenge the police to come in and arrest him or something like that. I think that's a bit unlikely to happen. I think one way or another, the letter of the law will be obeyed. It probably won't be Boris Johnson's signature on the letter. There will be some hapless civil servant.
Yeah. Finally, the Queen's speech is today, where they outline their plans for normal business, shall we say. But there was a cartoon in yesterday's Sunday Times which showed the Queen with Pinocchio's nose growing and growing, suggesting that whatever she says in her speech, as scripted by the government, will be just one big lie.
Well, it's a very unusual Queen's speech that the monarch is basically being invited down to the House of Commons at 11:30 this morning to read out sections of the Conservative Party manifesto. It's a very odd state of affairs. Boris Johnson wants to have an election now, and the only reason he hasn't had one is because the opposition parties for the moment are blocking it. So he's asking the Queen to come down and read out a legislative programme which will never be enacted. He's got a majority of minus 40. None of this is ever going to get through this Parliament. And basically what the Queen's going to be doing in her finery on the steps of the Golden Throne will be reading out the Conservative Manifesto. I can't imagine it will be do anything for already strained relations between the Prime Minister and the monarch.
George Parker, thank you very much for joining us, political editor with the Financial Times. Jack Parrock, Brussels correspondent for Euronews, has been listening, as has Sean Defoe, Communicore Group political correspondent. I'll come to Sean in a moment or two. But first, Jack, since you're close to the action in the tunnel, can you tell us anything that is emerging in terms of the stalling deal or the slowly moving forward deal?
Well, we know that the EU side has said that there's been intense negotiations over the weekend on this issue of the Irish border. The suggestion at the moment is that they're discussing some sort of arrangement where Northern Ireland would remain in a customs union with the United Kingdom, but would retain their EU customs regulations, meaning that there would be no need for border checks over the Irish border. That's what we understand, but we don't know what the technical resolutions for that would work, how they would work, whether there's an idea of being time limited or anything like that. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, has been saying that there is the talks have been constructive, but they've been difficult and there's a long way to go. The Irish Deputy Prime Minister, Simon Coveney, he's attending a ministers' meeting in Luxembourg today, and on his way in, he said that he thought that there could be perhaps a deal by the end of the month or even the end of the week. So there's sort of a lot of mixed messaging. We don't know really how well it's going, Pat, but there is obviously a lot of legwork going on here in Brussels.
Now, Jean-Claude Juncker said that should Boris Johnson write for an extension, even though it might not be that mindful to give it, but it would be unhistoric to refuse. So it's a nice turn of phrase.
Exactly. There's a strong sense here in Brussels that even if a deal is done, there probably will need to be some kind of extension just to go through the process of getting it enacted in the places where it needs to, like the European Parliament, like in Westminster. So there is an understanding that an extension could be granted. It's really the French President, Emmanuel Macron, who is really against extensions. He wants Brexit to be done and dusted. He wants it over so that he can continue and spend more time on pursuing his idea of sort of Eurozone integration. But even the French would be okay with an extension if they had a real reason, and especially if a deal was on the table that they expected to be able to pass in Westminster.
Now, you mentioned Emmanuel Macron, and he and Angela Merkel had a dinner. And it's interesting that, you know, they're aware that an independent Britain outside of the EU, irrespective of what trade is going to be done, is going to be a competitor of the EU, which is something that Boris Johnson tries to gloss over when he refers to my friends in Europe, because they will, in trade terms, become competitors.
This is it, Pat. There was actually a real change in rhetoric from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel after this dinner she had on Sunday night with French President Emmanuel Macron. Throughout the Brexit process, both sides have continued to say, you know, we're going to be great friends, we're going to be great neighbours, we're going to keep trading positively. And one of the conversations that they had surrounding Brexit,
Okay, we seem to have lost Jack and his line to Brussels. If we get it back, we'll come back and just address that point about Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron. But Sean Defoe is listening in to get the domestic on all of this. Sean, good morning.
Morning, Pat.
Some of the stuff we're getting on the text. It's obvious the meeting between Varadkar and Johnson was an election stunt between two desperately power-hungry individuals. That's from Joe. John says, we're told there's going to be a great effort made, but obstacles remain. It's all spin. We won't know until we know. So to say that the Tories and the DUP now believe Brexit is in a grave risk if there's an extension, that's what Johnson is gambling on. It's 50-50, says John, but really, none of us know anything. So I'm depending on you, Sean, to know something.
To reveal the cabinet secrets suddenly and quickly. I'm afraid I might let you down so, Pat, because, I mean, really, we are all watching, as you've set out with Georgia and Jack there. There's so many different permutations that could come out of this week. It's the one we thought maybe finally we will see some form of a deal or some end to this process, but okay. Now it looks it may bleed on.
Sean, will you just pause there, because Jack is back, and I'll conclude the point with Jack about Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel. Jack, when we lost you, you were saying that there was a change in the attitude of Angela Merkel when she emerged from the dinner and what she was saying.
Yeah, that's it. I'm sorry. I think the line dropped there, Pat. But basically, the change in her tone was to start talking about the UK as a direct competitor on the international markets. They were talking about artificial intelligence, and she started talking about how the UK would then become a sort of competitor. And as I said before, in everything else, it's always been friendly neighbours, we'll work together. And now I think there's a sense that if the UK exits, and even as a powerful country with a deal, and there's a bit more friendship there, that the UK will become a sort of trade adversary potentially.
All right. So this is emerging in the latter stages of these talks, but it puts, I suppose, a context on the technical difficulties of asking the UK, a competitor, to impose EU tariffs on the way into Northern Ireland and hoping that it will live up to its word.
This is it. And it's a really interesting time for her to have said this, right? At this crunch moment, this week, where really a Brexit deal needs to be done if there's going to be no deal, as we all expect it to happen. I will say, actually, what Angela Merkel is saying, it is something that's sort of generally been understood in the back doors, that essentially that, you know, the UK will be outside of the single market and will be not on the same trading lines as the EU, and therefore anybody who's sort of not with you is against you. That's generally the way it works, and especially what we've seen with the US and the way that Donald Trump has changed their trade policies. On the international markets, there is a sense that things can be changed and that traditional allies aren't always holding out for each other.
All right, Jack, thank you very much for joining us. And that's Jack Parrock, Brussels correspondent for Euronews. Sorry for the interruption, Sean, but we want to get what is emerging domestically now. Jack was quoting from Simon Coveney being optimistic about a deal being done.
Optimistic but realistic, I would think, is the government mood at the moment. They still think that there was a breakthrough with Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson's meeting last Thursday. That has somewhat dampened over the weekend, given what we've seen coming out from the tunnel, which has been serious concerns over how that customs partnership that seems to be the suggestion would be managed. It's not really the same as any other border in the world. There's a lot of technical solutions that need to be worked out with it, and you would be doubtful that can be done this week, if alone this month. But they do believe that there is goodwill now on the UK side. But it's going to be tight. It's going to be really tight if they're going to get it done this week. Typically, when the European Council leaders meet, they don't do the negotiating at those tables. It's all done in the early days of this week, and usually the negotiations will be concluded on Tuesday and Wednesday at the General Affairs Council and then rubber stamped by the European leaders. So really, we need to see movement in the next 48 hours at the latest if we're actually going to get a deal, and you'd have to say that's unlikely.
Now, we all have to share the island, and I'm just wondering how the government would be reacting to the hardening of the position on the part of the DUP, and also a story in one of yesterday's newspapers on the front page of maybe it was the Sunday Times, saying, you know, loyalist dissidents would be reacting possibly in a violent way against any change in Northern Ireland's status in terms of the way it's being treated.
it's a really, really difficult one. The DUP have always been the great question mark over these, and whenever we've had a deal, it seems to be the DUP who have opposed it. They have a very, very simple position, as outlined by some of their MPs. If they are treated differently to England, they won't vote for it. And that's the very simple position that they have at the moment, and it looks as though under this partnership that they would. Now, you would think that Boris Johnson, if he thinks this is going to work, has some sort of assurances from the DUP. We haven't crucially seen anything out of the tunnel in regard to consent for Northern Ireland and how that would work. So I'm wondering, is there some sort of mechanism in there that they feel is enough to bring the DUP on side? But it seems very, very hard at the moment. And as you outlined with George Parker, it may only be 10 votes, but they're 10 very crucial votes. And they're also 10 very influential votes in Northern Ireland in terms of how people are going to react to this. And while there is probably a majority in Northern Ireland who doesn't want Brexit altogether and who would see this as a bad deal for them, there are still sections of society who, if there is a significant break with the rest of the UK, are going to react badly.
You know, we look at what the DUP are saying, and we know that they would fashion a Northern Ireland remarkably different in many, many ways to the regime that exists in England. And I mean, if you look at Scotland, their student grants, for example, are very different to, and much, I think they're much more generous. Fees are less in Scotland than they are in England. So in so many ways, there can be autonomy in different regions. And you wonder, is this just simply about that visceral fear that any change in the status of Northern Ireland seems to weaken the union? And it's all about that, even though we know on the other side, there are many who'd cut the strings to of that union without a second thought.
Yeah, and probably would have done so if it wasn't for their reliance on the DUP in Parliament at the moment. I mean, that is the great fear of many unionists in this process, that eventually the weakening of their relationship with the rest of the UK is going to lead to a border poll and a united Ireland here. And then that would be complete and utter disaster for them. And you can completely understand where a lot of unionists are coming from and where that fear is based. So I suppose what has to be done to reassure them is that they are still very much part of the UK, even in whatever new arrangement that there is. And I think this customs partnership idea tries to get to that they would be in a UK-wide customs union, even if they're applying tariffs. But there's a huge amount of, even if we take away the DUP view and their potential opposition to it, there's a huge amount of other concerns about that idea. That, you know, how would you actually apply all these different tariff rates? The suggestion seems to be that any goods coming from the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland would have an EU tariff slapped on them at the ports, and then you'd get a rebate if it's only going as far as Northern Ireland.
Yeah, but like people who shop, Americans who shop, they get a VAT rebate if they apply for it as they leave the country. So that sort of thing. Anyway, we will wait and see. Sean, thank you very much for joining us. Sean Defoe, who is the group political correspondent for Communicore.